Hello, I'm Lino Khmudu. Welcome to Health Chat. Innovation, research and development are key in medicine. HIV, the human immunodeficiency virus that attacks the body's immune system, has caused many people to become sick and others to lose their lives. According to the United Nations, about 39 million people were living with HIV at the end of 2022. An estimated 0.7% of adults between the age of 15 and 49 years worldwide are living with HIV. Although the burden of the epidemic continues to vary considerably between countries and regions, according to observers. Now, research and medical discoveries have enabled scientists to create better tools, helping HIV patients to live healthier lives and live longer with the virus today. One such medical advancement is emtricitabine, a drug used along with other medications to treat HIV infection. Emtricitabine is in a class of medications called nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors, NRTIs. It works by decreasing the amount of HIV in the blood, and we will help understand and comprehend all of this with our guest today. On today's program, we have an exclusive interview with Dr. Dennis Liota, Samuel Candler Dobbs Professor, Department of Chemistry at Emory University. Professor Liota's work on emtricitabine helped transform HIV from a death sentence into a manageable illness, saving tens of millions of lives. Professor Liota is joining us live via phone. Professor Liota, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us. I said a few words there, and some of them I probably butchered them.
You did well.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So first and foremost, the drug that you most definitely helped create, would you tell us about it? I said it, emtricitabine. What is it? How does it work?
Sure. Well, emtricitabine is a, as you described it, is a nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor. So what we try to do with any disease, especially an infectious disease, is we try to look for targets that are at least distinctive, but preferably unique to the pathogen in question. So HIV has a series of enzymes, and one of them is a polymerase. It's a way of making the nucleic acid that's associated with the virus. And so we try to target that because it's different enough from the human polymerase, we can selectively inhibit it without touching the human polymerase. And that's one of the things that emtricitabine does very well. And the way it does it is it fools the virus. The virus thinks that it's one of the normal four building blocks of DNA, and it structurally resembles it, but when it incorporates it, it's missing a key component, what we call a 3' hydroxyl group that is needed to extend that growing chain of DNA. And so we never get DNA that's long enough to be functional. So if I could just give you an analogy, if you have a series of train cars, and someone knowledgeable is deciding which car to put in next. So you have a blue, a yellow, a green, and a red, and it's choosing which one. And when you put in this oddball structure, it doesn't have a linker to hook on to the next trailer car. So everything just stops. Mm-hmm. And so we call that chain termination, and that's what emtricitabine is, a chain terminator.
Amtricitabine. I'm so glad you said it for me to know how to better pronounce it. So listen, Professor Yota, you know, HIV has been such a challenge from the very beginning, even up until now. After all these years, one of the examples is the fact that there is still no vaccine, right? For this specific virus. What prompted you to look in that direction, particularly to come up with this product that is helping so many people today?
Well, it's an interesting story. When I wasn't trained as a medicinal chemist, and I didn't have a lot of expertise in virology, so I was one of the least likely people to get involved in drug discovery. But in the late 1980s, I knew many people who were HIV positive. Some of them were amongst the most creative and likable people I had ever met, and they were getting sick and they were dying. And I didn't feel like the pharmaceutical industry was doing enough to try and find a cure, or at least a drug to control these diseases. So at some point, you start to say, if not me, then who?
Yeah.
Or if not now, then when? And in my case, I just felt like I couldn't do any worse than the pharmaceutical companies were doing. So I decided that I was just going to take the plunge. And I got myself some collaborators who knew a bit about virology, and I was off and running.
Very interesting. And now, today, as I mentioned, many people are using it, and it's used in different drugs. Who is a good candidate for this drug?
Well, one of the things about HIV that makes it different than a lot of other diseases, and you hit on it, is that you really need combinations. A single drug, which we call a monotherapy, doesn't work because the virus is always mutating, and these mutations will change one of the amino acid residues, that will, in certain cases, that will affect its potency. So in the case of HIV, if you do something to make the drug less potent, then you have to give a lot more drug to have the same effect. So what we do to counter that is we give a combination of drugs, usually three drugs. And the reason is that each of them can cover mutations that the virus makes in different ways, but together they cover the whole spectrum of mutants that appear. And that means that the virus is never able to generate a mutant that can overcome the therapeutic power of the combination of drugs that you're using. And emtricitabine is particularly useful because, by the grace of God, it pairs up well with many other antiretroviral agents. So that's what makes it so effective. It's pretty safe, it's very potent, and it pairs up well with other antiretroviral agents, so we can create different combinations for different resistance profiles to make sure that we can control viral replication.
So today, combination therapy is, as you explain, is one way, if not the main recommendation for many people who have HIV. What is the future of HIV treatment at this point when it comes to research? Are you working on anything new? Are you trying to come up with different version of emtricitabine? Or what does the future of HIV research looks like in terms of treatment?
That's an excellent question. So the answer in my case is yes. You know, the breakthrough in HIV research came in 2006 when they were able to combine three drugs in one pill that was taken once a day. To contrast that, 10 years before that, people had to take 10 or 15 drugs a day, some as many as three times a day. And that meant that compliance levels were very low. If you've ever taken a drug that you have to take three times a day, maybe the first one you take with your breakfast, the second one sometime in the afternoon, but that third one's coming in the middle of the night. And chances are, at least some of the time, you're not going to take that. And if you do, your protection level goes down. And if it goes down sufficiently, then viral replication can start up again, and you can start to find resistant virus that your combination will no longer work against. So three drugs in one pill once a day was an absolute breakthrough. That was the combination drug called Atripla. Now, it's given once a day. Now, can you imagine if you could take it once a month or once every 2 months or 3 months? And if we could, then assuming that the cost of that particular combination would be not too different from the costs we have now, we'd have enough money to treat every person in the world who is HIV positive. And right now, as you know, it's still quite a scourge in Africa. I was just there 2 weeks ago, and the problem is still, one, we know how to control the disease, but we don't have sufficient resources to treat everybody. So if we could do something where we could give it once a month or once every 2 months, then the economics would be very favorable, and we would have a chance of just controlling the spread of the disease worldwide. And that's one of our goals.
What about in terms of prevention? One of the reasons we hear about the fact that there is still no vaccine, and you mentioned it, is the fact that the HIV virus does mutate. So what are your thoughts in terms of the urgency of finding a way to prevent HIV transmission?
Well, so we do have a way of doing it with drugs. It's called pre-exposure prophylaxis.
Yes.
And right. It's a two or three drug combination that if you have a discordant couple where one partner is HIV positive and the other is HIV negative, the HIV negative person can take these drugs prophylactically. They can take them to prevent the onset of infection. And they're pretty effective, but again, it's also it's the expense factor where that comes into play. But that pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is oftentimes called PrEP,
yes,
has helped a lot of people. A lot of couples live fairly normal existences. So that's I think a big step forward. But we still don't have a vaccine, and a vaccine, it remains a very big challenge. And the reason is, if I could give you a couple of numbers, you might see the problem with it, is that HIV, every time it replicates, there's about one in every 10,000 replications causes an error, a mutation. And the disease does about a trillion replications a day. So that's 10 to the ninth for those who like mathematics, but a trillion. So you can imagine that things are happening very fast. Even in a day, you have a lot of mutations. Well, the problem with the vaccine is there's an outside loop, and that's what the our antibodies tend to recognize. And we describe this loop as hypervariable. It's mutating all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the body will try and create an antibody against it, but it will take several days to produce enough of that antibody to be effective. But by that time, that loop has mutated extensively, so those antibodies that were created are no longer able to control that particular new virus mutant that occurs. So we say that the escape mutants are produced faster than the body can make antibodies against it. So it's a race we're constantly losing.
Yes, that's really concerning right there. And before we let you go, I wanted to ask you, you received the inaugural Bayh-Dole Coalition American Innovator Award last week. You were awarded that. What are your thoughts, quickly, what does this mean to you and to the work in terms of research and the big picture?
Yeah, so it was a, of course, a wonderful honor. I think every scientist dreams about having their work being impactful, and dreams about having their work turn into a product that can dramatically improve the health of the public. If you're interested in biomedical sciences, that's usually one of our goals. So personally, of course, it was a great honor. But I think there's a bigger picture, too, about innovation. And I think that many of our advances in the biomedical sciences have come from innovations, not just innovations in a big pharmaceutical company, but innovations in an academic laboratory. There are a lot of people with a lot of ideas. And so this, to me, that award says it's an award to innovators. And, you know, when I go to Africa, I'm always so impressed by the level of innovation and entrepreneurship that exists there. We go there routinely. I'm part of a team that does workshops for innovators to try and assist them to bring their products forward. And Africans have this great notion of finding African solutions for African problems. And so I think that the bigger message from this Bayh-Dole Face of Innovation Award is the notion that innovations are being recognized and rewarded, and I'd like to see governments do more to spur innovation, to facilitate its translation from a concept to a product or service that benefits the public. So I hope it's the first of many recognitions of innovative ideas that were turned into products, and I'm confident that you have great raw material in Africa to do this, and just we need the infrastructure and support to take those ideas and make them viable.
Thank you so much, Professor Dennis Liotta. We appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
I thank you very much. Have a nice day.
That was Professor Dennis Liotta. He's a chemistry professor at Emory University. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
This week on Straight Talk Africa, leaders from over 150 countries are gathering in New York for the annual UN General Assembly. This year, the war in Ukraine and climate change are expected to monopolize conversations. What is the status of the Sustainable Development Goals? Join me, Haiti Adams, and my guests on the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
I'm Nabil Biagio. Coming up today on South Sudan in Focus, South Sudan's SPLM in opposition says its leader and first vice president Riek Machar faced restrictions preventing him from attending the UN General Assembly despite being invited. And clashes in South Sudan's Pibor administrative area have resulted in several casualties and the displacement of hundreds of people. This is Stories and More at 6:30 UTC in Juba and 1700 UTC in Kenya on VOA Africa.
Welcome back to Health Chat. United Nations agencies have issued a warning about the potential for disease outbreaks in the flood-stricken city of Derna in Libya. The flash floods that occurred on September 10th caused significant damage and left over 30,000 residents in need of basic necessities such as clean water and food. The bursting of two river dams resulted in a tidal wave that destroyed residential areas and raised concerns about contaminated water and sanitation issues. In a statement released Monday, the UN support mission in Libya, UNSMIL, said it has sent 9 teams in the North African nations to deliver aid and support those affected by the flood. And the flood that swept away entire neighborhoods in parts of Libya left significant damage and devastation. Karen Donnelly, Senior Vice President for Crisis Response, Recovery and Development with the International Rescue Committee, discusses what an effective disaster response entails and how issues such as waterborne diseases could be prevented. Take a listen.
Libya was struck by a significant storm. Torrential downpours of rain led to significant flooding, including most devastatingly in the city of Derna, where two dams burst and a huge flood of water flowed into the city and washed away significant chunks of the neighborhood. So in Derna itself, there are thousands of people who've been confirmed as killed, thousands more who are missing, many of whom are also feared dead. Tens of thousands of people have been displaced and have lost their homes and livelihoods. Communities have been destroyed. There's also been destruction and devastation in other parts of Libya. The International Rescue Committee has 180 staff working in different parts of the country. We work in a town called Shahat, which is to the west of Derna. We have a health program operating there. Our staff there have been affected. Thankfully, our staff are safe, but many of their families have been affected. We've been responding and supporting the Ministry of Health in Shahat, but also we're able to send a team to assess the damage in Derna.
What are some of the issues that people are facing on the ground?
Yeah, so as you can imagine, it's a very chaotic and fast-moving situation on the ground. People are moving out of the affected areas, seeking safety, seeking refuge. The immediate priorities are medical assistance, helping, making sure people are taken care of, treating the survivors. Many of the health facilities in those areas have themselves been damaged and destroyed, lost their stocks of pharmaceutical supplies, other equipment. So getting doctors and nurses into the area, we've been transporting Ministry of Health staff to affected areas, getting pharmaceutical supplies, medical equipment in, but also the basic relief items that people need. People need cooking utensils, blankets, they've lost everything. So first priority, help the survivors, help the living, help those who need immediate assistance. But there's a larger recovery effort that's going to be needed. As I said, in Derna in particular, in other areas, huge amounts of infrastructure have been destroyed and there's going to need to be a reconstruction effort there. All of this is compounded by the reality that Libya has experienced over a decade of conflict and political instability. The country is currently essentially divided with two competing administrations governing the eastern and western parts of the country. And so social services, public services, maintenance of public infrastructure are all things that have suffered and have been in decline in recent years. So the starting point for many of these affected communities was at quite a low baseline. And this disaster just further compounds their ability to provide for themselves, provide for their families.
Given the current and possible future impact of the flood, how can issues such as waterborne diseases be prevented?
Yeah, you know, I want to pick up on the public health threat from waterborne diseases in particular. And again, in Derna, where they suffered the worst devastation, we're really worried about the risk of, as you say, cholera and other diseases emerging. Not only has the water supply infrastructure itself been destroyed, but there's significant contamination from sewage systems that have been damaged, from waste facilities, from fuel from vehicles and petrol gas stations that have been damaged. So water, to the extent that it is available, is certainly not safe and puts people at risk, and that risk only grows over time. So the immediate need is in water tanking, new water facilities. Water purification is something that we're exploring with some partners as to how we might be able to, at scale, support Libyan authorities, Libyan communities to purify water at scale. When it comes to future developments, how do we protect against something like this happening again? Obviously, in this particular instance, the bulk of the devastation was occurred by the failure of two dams. So ensuring adequate maintenance to public infrastructure is critical, but so too is predicting the impacts of future extreme weather events. We know that with the climate crisis, extreme weather events, torrential downpours and floods are likely to be more frequent. And so infrastructure that was developed decades ago in many cases isn't fit for purpose, even when it is well maintained, which it often isn't in many countries, when it comes to the threats they're likely to face. So predicting or projecting forward, estimating as best we can the likelihood of extreme weather events and ensuring that construction standards in the reconstruction effort in Derna and elsewhere in Libya take that into account is going to be critical to protecting communities in the future.
So what does an effective disaster response entail in general?
First and foremost, it's one that keeps people alive and does so rapidly with as much dignity as possible, involving communities in leading their own response. The International Rescue Committee's team that reached Derna yesterday found, as we always find in disaster response, that the first responders are local communities. There are Libyan authorities, there are civil society organizations and private individuals who have mobilized and are delivering assistance alongside our teams and a small number of other international organizations. But it's quite a chaotic response. And so coordination is really important to understand who's most vulnerable, where are the biggest needs, and how do we direct the aid that's coming in to reach those most in need. So that kind of efficiency and effectiveness of the response is critical. Understanding the needs and priorities of the local community is also essential. They know and they are better able than we are to determine what their priorities are. And so listening to them, being guided by them is critical. And then I want to talk about scale, because right now what we see is first responders arriving, but the scale of the needs far outstripping the response. And of course, logistics are challenging. Roads have been damaged. Telecommunications have been damaged. But we need to get significantly more resources into the affected areas in the coming days in order to be able to meet the needs at the scale at which we're seeing.
And when a disaster happens, what are the challenges to getting a quick response to save lives?
Often it's logistics, and sometimes it's the administrative barriers that go around logistics. So we have physical challenges. Some of the roads accessing Derna have been washed out. You can imagine a small city that you could drive across in a matter of minutes. Now it's a 100-kilometer journey to drive around just to get into an access road into the city. Those roads are crowded with people leaving the city, other people trying to access the city, and the division of the country between two different administrations. Although I do want to note that we've seen quite good cooperation so far from Libyan authorities, visas issued rapidly, airports being opened up, and so on. But, global supply chains are, as we know, challenged by some of the lingering effects of the pandemic, by the effects of the Ukraine crisis. So getting the needed supplies into a country like Libya rapidly is something that, sadly, regrettably, will take at least a number of days and possibly weeks. Meanwhile, people on the ground are in real need.
And what is your final message?
Don't write off this disaster. I know that your screens have been flooded with Morocco, with Ukraine, with Yemen. This is the latest in a series of just unimaginable tragedies that have occurred. It is possible to help. You can visit our website, rescue.org/Libya, to find out more about how the International Rescue Committee is responding. There are many other organizations you can explore as well. Don't turn away.
Karen Donnelly, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Great. Thank you for having me.
And that's all for today. Thank you so much for listening in. I'm your host, Lynor Mundou, in Washington with producer Nicole Peters. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.